Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, the future of the court. Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement paves the way for President Biden to fulfill his campaign promise and nominate the first black woman to the Supreme Court. Then, a wave of violence. Many cities grapple with a steady increase in crime. We examine the potential causes and solutions. And a long recovery. We return to tornado-ravaged Western Kentucky to examine the lingering aftermath and the difficult path toward healing.
This is not a one-week repair here, or a two-week, or a six-month. This is years of commitment. And when the fanfare is over, the work is still here and has to be done.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The process of filling a coming vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court can now begin in earnest. Justice Stephen Breyer formally announced today that he is stepping down, setting the stage for a Senate confirmation battle. The NewsHour's Jeff Bennett begins our coverage.
President Biden and Justice Stephen Breyer together at the White House today to announce Breyer's retirement from the Supreme Court.
I'm here today to express the nation's gratitude to Justice Stephen Breyer for his remarkable career of public service.
Breyer served more than 27 years on the nation's highest court, a career he called challenging and meaningful, in a letter informing the president of his intent to retire at the end of the court's term.
It's a kind of miracle when you sit there and see all those people in front of you, people that are so different in what they think, and yet they've decided to help solve their major differences under law.
The announcement gives President Biden an opportunity to deliver on a key campaign promise, nominating an African-American woman to the Supreme Court.
While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view.
The president said his process of selecting a nominee will be rigorous, and he will seek the advice of the Senate, getting input from lawmakers of both parties, as well as scholars, lawyers, and Vice President Kamala Harris, herself an attorney. He said he expects to announce his selection before the end of February. The current frontrunners include U.S. Circuit Court Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was nominated by former President Obama, then elevated by President Biden to the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C. Early in her career, she worked as a law clerk under Breyer. California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Krueger, also a former U.S. Supreme Court clerk, she has argued a dozen cases in federal court. And federal judge J. Michelle Childs of South Carolina, who's been nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. She's a favorite of South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn, the House Majority Whip, who was instrumental in Biden's win.
I fully expect
Breyer's retirement also marks a full circle moment for the president, who chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee during Breyer's 1994 confirmation.
I was proud and grateful to be there at the start of this distinguished career in the Supreme Court, and I'm very proud to be here today.
The nomination will be one of the most consequential choices of Biden's presidency and could offer him a political lifeline ahead of the 2022 midterm elections. Breyer's retirement giving the president a chance to nominate his first Supreme Court justice, a history-making selection while reinforcing the high court's liberal minority. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeff Bennett in Washington.
It's not known exactly when President Biden will select his Supreme Court nominee, but the Senate confirmation battle is already taking shape on Capitol Hill. Here to explain how it could all play out is congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins. So hello, Lisa. We know this is happening, as we know, at a time when there is a 50-50 divided Senate. What does the process look like that we should expect to see?
Well, I'll tell you, a slow week on Capitol Hill sure got busy fast for many Capitol Hill staffers. I want to tell people that the 50-50 Senate will mean a slightly different process for President Biden, maybe a more difficult process for him than was the process for President Trump. Let me take folks through this. That first step in the process, of course, is the Judiciary Committee. And in the 50-50 Senate, it is 11 Democrats and 11 Republicans. A tie vote in that committee for a nominee fails the nominee. Now, if there is a tie, however, Democrats can get around that by using a discharge process. That's something they've used repeatedly with judicial nominees. Then the nominee would go to the full Senate, where a Supreme Court nominee currently requires only a majority vote. There is not the 60-vote threshold involved any longer for Supreme Court nominees. Now, the question is, how much will Republicans fight this nominee? And of course, who the nominee will make a very big difference. This is one reason that the White House, we can report from Jeff Bennett, getting sources at the White House, telling us that the Biden administration wants this to be a judge, not someone who is outside of the judicial sphere. Let's look at those three judges that Jeff mentioned in his piece, and I can report what Democrats are telling me on the Hill as they see the different advantages to each one. The first is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, she's someone, interestingly enough, that Biden personally interviewed last year before he elevated her to the Court of Appeals. Now, Justice Liana Kruger of California, she is someone who's seen as more of a moderate, someone who perhaps could gain more Republican support. And then Michelle Childs of South Carolina. She is someone who already has some Republican support. South Carolina's senators Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott saying that they support her. And of course, Judy, as we heard in Jeff's piece, so does Jim Clyburn, that real pivotal figure in the Biden administration, has a lot of influence. Here's what Representative Clyburn said last night on CNN.
I want us to make sure that it is a black woman. I want to make sure that it's a woman that will get universal support. When I say universal, I mean bipartisan support. And I know that Michelle Childs will have support of several Republicans, including the two Republican senators from South Carolina.
And how about this for timing, Judy? Next week, Judge Childs is to appear for her confirmation hearing for the Court of Appeals. So a very rare potential tryout, if you will, for this woman who is getting a lot of attention in this moment.
So, Lisa, is it your understanding that both parties already have their strategy figured out for how they're going to approach this?
You know, again, it depends on the nominee. But yes, let's talk about what we know at this moment. Republican leader Mitch McConnell today told reporters that he will give the nominee a fair look. He has said he doesn't want someone who's from the radical left, but he said he's not going into this with his mind made up. Senator Schumer, for the Democrats' part, says he wants a fair and quick process. I'm told that he would like the entire process to last about a month from the time the nominee is announced. Again, who the nominee is will matter. Republicans do have one method of blocking a potential Supreme Court nominee. It's a bit weedy, but essentially they could just not show up for a committee vote. Democrats don't have a workaround for that. But right now, both parties seem to want a smooth and easy path forward. No drama at this moment.
Interesting. And just finally, Lisa, as we know, the Democrats have a number of things on their agenda right now. How does this Supreme Court nomination process, how is it seen that that could affect what they're trying to get through meanwhile?
The calendar's getting busy again, Judy. Let's look. First of all, if you look at these 3 weeks now ahead, Democrats will be working on potentially a China competitiveness bill, electoral college reform. Then on February 18th, we have government funding set to run out. After that, Republicans and Democrats both go on recess in the Senate. And that is right when the president's goal is for having a nominee. Of course, right after that, March 1st, State of the Union. That's when President Biden wants this nominee announced and the process to be underway. So it's going to be a busy few weeks.
Certainly looks like it. Lisa Desjardins, thanks very much. In the day's other news, the U.S. economy rebounded strongly in 2021, with the best growth since 1984. The U.S. Commerce Department reports that the nation's gross domestic product increased 5.7%. The jump was driven by strong consumer spending and private investment. Separately, new unemployment claims fell last week for the first time in a month to 260,000. This was the deadline for health care workers in nearly half of the states to comply with a federal COVID-19 vaccine mandate. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the requirement earlier this month. It extends nationwide in the next few weeks. Also today, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona urged schools to spend federal pandemic aid on tutors to help students who have fallen behind. In Russia, the Kremlin says there is little room for optimism after the U.S. rejected its security demands. But it says that dialogue on Ukraine is still possible. That came as Russian fighter jets landed in Belarus today for exercises north of the Ukrainian border. To the east, tanks and guns took part in maneuvers. Still, Moscow insisted it won't start a war.
From our side, we have repeatedly stated that our country doesn't plan to attack anyone. We consider even a thought about war between our peoples unacceptable.
The White House said that it hopes the Russians are not playing games with diplomacy. And President Biden spoke by phone with Ukraine's President Zelensky. U.S. officials said Mr. Biden again promised a decisive response if Russia invades Ukraine. China is demanding that the U.S. stop interfering in the Beijing Winter Olympics, an apparent reference to a U.S.-led diplomatic boycott of the Games. The Chinese Foreign Minister and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke by phone today. The Chinese quoted the minister as saying, "The U.S. continuously puts forward wrong words and actions toward China, causing new conflicts in relations." The Pentagon put out new guidance today on limiting civilian casualties from airstrikes. It calls for standardized reporting and response and a special office focused on the problem. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is also asking for plans to ensure that limiting civilian casualties is a priority in each mission. The U.S. Coast Guard has found four more bodies in the search for dozens of migrants off of Florida's Atlantic coast. That word came today as vessels continue to look for 34 people whose crowded boat capsized over the weekend. But officials said they expect the rescue operation to end this evening.
It does mean that we don't think it's likely that anyone else has survived. And again, that's why we say we're suspending and not closing. That's based on the best information we have right now.
The boat had sailed from the Bahamas. Only one survivor has been found. A congressional watchdog issued a stinging review today of the Department of Health and Human Services over the pandemic and other challenges. The Government Accountability Office said that HHS has mismanaged the medical supply chain and is not ready for weather disasters or bioterror attacks. The GAO designated the department as a high-risk sector of government. And on Wall Street, stocks gave up early gains as investors remained uneasy about inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 34,160. The Nasdaq fell 189 points, nearly 1.5%. The S&P 500 slipped 23. Still to come on the NewsHour, we return to tornado-ravaged western Kentucky to examine the lingering aftermath. Moderna's chief medical officer discusses the ongoing fight against COVID-19. Children go to great lengths to get an education amid ongoing bombings in Syria, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer will leave behind a storied legacy as he prepares to step down after more than 27 years on the bench. To reflect on what his absence will mean for the future of the court, I'm joined by two legal veterans. Gregory Garr, a former U.S. Solicitor General who has argued several cases in front of the court, and former acting U.S. Solicitor General Neil Katyal, who clerked for Justice Breyer. Welcome to the program to both of you. Neil Katyal, I'm going to ask you first, what was it like to argue a case before Justice Breyer?
It was always tough. I've done 45 of them before him, and he is able to get to the heart of the issue, at least in the way he sees it, with usually a long hypothetical. The advantage of that would be that you'd have time to think about the hypothetical before answering it, unlike, say, Justice Kagan, who has more staccato questioning style. And it allowed a conversation between justice and advocate. So I thought he was just phenomenal at oral argument. It was always a delight. And his written opinions are really works to behold.
Gregory Garr, what about you? You also argued before Justice Breyer. How was he different from the other justices?
He's a real delight to appear before. And I think, as Neil said, is what's most distinctive about his style at oral argument is he would ask very long questions and would immediately bring you back as a law student. And you were trying to keep up with questions and answer them. And it was a great challenge, but also a lot of fun during oral argument.
This is kind of a big question, Neil Katyal, but what would you say his main contributions were over the course of his career on the court? And it's not ended. He's there till the summer.
Yeah, I would say the president today singled out a line that Justice Breyer said in his confirmation hearings back in the 1990s, that he believed government should work for the people. And that was really his mantra, both when I was clerking for him, and you see it in the written opinions that he's authored. And it means really listening to experts on things like COVID regulation or greenhouse gas regulations or affordable health care, things like that, all of which he fought hard for and was often successful in winning those battles at the court. He really does, to my mind, carry on Chief Justice John Marshall's legacy of trying to, you know, interpret a constitution in a flexible way that's adapted to the crises of human affairs.
What is your perspective on that, Gregory Garr? How do you see what difference he's made as a justice?
I think that's right. I mean, the one thing that was really different about Justice Breyer is he was very much a pragmatist, very much a consensus builder, and you could see that in his opinions. He was in favor of multi-factor tests and balancing inquiries, which in some sense could frustrate people looking for a clear rule, but in other sense was easy to adapt to the particular facts before him. And that's an important part of his legacy. And I also think that more recently, he's been very outspoken in defending the court as an institution, including against attacks and suggestions of court packing and the like. And I think that that will end up being an important part of his legacy as well, his defense of the court.
And I wanted to ask the two of you about that, because it seems Justice Breyer's gone out of his way in recent months, years, even, to talk about the importance of a court that is not seen as partisan. I saw today that even Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, in his statement, praised Justice Breyer for what he said was his commitment to the importance of a nonpartisan, non-politicized judiciary. He said it's been especially admirable. Neil Katyal, is that something we can expect to see continue on the court, this push for the court to remain in some way nonpartisan?
Well, I hope so, but I think it's tough, because I think losing Justice Breyer is losing the most solid, most reliable vote for civility and apolitical interpretation of the law. I mean, that's what his career stood for. I mean, as law clerks, you know, we're 26 years old or so. We get upset when we see our boss attacked. Justice Scalia, for example, attacked him in some written opinion. We wanted him to say something back, and that was never what he did, never once, because he believed so much in civility. And I think you saw it also in his speech today that Justice Breyer gave at the White House, in which he started by talking about what is the majesty of the law. It's that 330 million Americans were far-flung of every religion and race and political ideology. They agree to resolve their differences through the rule of law. That's, you know, something he really celebrated, and I hope that the other justices will take that up in the same way as he does. I think the Chief Justice has been a very strong part of that, and I expect that to continue.
Gregory Garr, how do you see the court in the future when it comes to any effort to keep it from appearing driven by partisanship?
I think all the justices will rally around that, because they'll see it as so important to the future and functioning of the institution. But I do think this is a very important point, and that the replacement, although may not move the court in terms of ideologically, because it will still only be three more liberal members. But the tone that the person takes could be quite important in terms of how the court is perceived, and you know, whether or not that person is going to be as ardent defender of the institution as Justice Breyer remains to be seen.
Neil Katyal, let's talk about how different could the court become. We presume we know who some of the names are who've been suggested. President Biden has made it clear he's going to appoint a black woman. How do we expect the court is going to change in the future with another justice?
Well, the Supreme Court is really quite conservative at this point, far more so than the American public. And you just flashed, Judy, on the screen a statistic which showed that, you know, Republicans have nominated 15 justices over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. Democrats have nominated four. And so that's really changed the matrix of the court a lot. And I think Greg is absolutely right to say that whoever replaces Justice Breyer is probably not going to change the ideology of the court very much, because it's maybe one relatively liberal justice being replaced by another one. So it's, in that sense, this vote's not quite as important. I do think some of the names that are being floated around, like Ketanji Jackson and Leandra Kruger, these are spectacular, spectacular names. And we're so lucky to have people like that on the so-called shortlist.
Gregory Gar, how do you see the court changing, given some of the names that are now out there?
I think that's right. I mean, I don't think we're going to see a big change in the replacement like we saw when Justice Barrett replaced Justice Ginsburg, which was a complete flip in the seat. But I do think that the tenor and tone that the new justice takes will be important. And the other thing that's going to happen is that Justice Sotomayor is going to become the senior justice in the liberal bloc, and so can decide, you know, when to take the lead on dissents or opinions where she's in the majority. And that could have a significant impact on the tone of the court's opinions as well.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, she's been a little bit more outspoken, and we've seen it more recently in some of her comments. For example, during the Texas case, it was argued a month or so ago, in really sort of calling out the conservative bloc for perhaps moving more quickly than she thinks that the court should. And so I think if she takes the role as the senior justice on the more liberal side and begins writing more frequently, I think we may see a more aggressive tone on the left.
Well, we are all certainly going to be watching this process as it moves ahead. Gregory Gar, Neil Katyal, thank you both very much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Recent shootings in New York City have spotlighted a troubling rise in gun violence and homicide across the country. Amna Nawaz has our report on why violent crime has increased and how cities can prevent it.
A grim start to the year in New York City, with residents across the boroughs reeling from a series of attacks. In Times Square, a woman pushed to death on the subway tracks. In the Bronx, an 11-month-old baby shot in the face. And in Harlem, two police officers shot to death while on duty. It sent newly inaugurated Mayor Eric Adams, a former NYPD captain, to prayer vigils, roundtables, and to the center of a national debate on gun violence and public safety.
We need Washington to join us and act now to stop the flow of guns in New York City and cities like New York.
The issue is resonating nationwide. Over the weekend, an officer was wounded in Washington, D.C., and a deputy killed in Houston, Texas.
We cannot have people like this on our streets.
The overall picture of violent crime in America right now is complicated. A new report by the Council on Criminal Justice tracks that. In 2021, the homicide rate rose by 5%, an increase, but by a much smaller margin than in 2020, when homicides rose by 29%. And these numbers are still only about half the rate during the nation's peak in the early 1990s. Still, it was top of mind for city leaders who gathered for a national mayor's conference in Washington, D.C. last week. There, Republicans and Democrats alike endorsed investing in police departments, like Miami Mayor Francis Suarez.
As we've invested in our police departments, we saw a shocking correlation. Crime went down.
And President Joe Biden.
We shouldn't be cutting funding for police departments. I propose increasing funding.
Back in New York on Monday, Mayor Adams echoed that message.
We will not surrender our city to the violent few.
Laying out a blueprint to end gun violence, to empower community anti-violence groups, expand programs for youth jobs and mental health, harsher sentences on gun trafficking, and an increased police presence on the streets.
The NYPD is our first line of defense against gun violence. We will make new efforts to strengthen and reinforce it while continuing our mission to involve the community.
That includes bringing back a remodeled version of plainclothes units, the teams behind a number of the city's most notorious police shootings, disbanded amid calls for reform in 2020. Adams said he would ensure they didn't repeat past mistakes.
We're not looking to be heavy-handed, but we're not looking to be dangerous to our city. And I'm going to find and strike that right balance.
New Yorkers can expect to see change on the streets in the coming weeks, a sign of one city's approach to violent crime.
To understand why violence is up nationwide and what policies can address this, I'm joined by Thomas Apt. He's the chair of the Council on Criminal Justice's Violent Crime Working Group, which studies evidence-based strategies for public safety. Thomas Apt, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being here. So as we mentioned there, the violent crime rates are not what we saw in the 1990s, but those increases, they show up. People see that and they feel that in their community. So what do we know is behind those increases? What's driving them?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you on that today. Basically, it's hard to tell what drives crime trends, but the experts broadly agree on three main reasons. First, it's the pandemic. As people know, the pandemic has placed everyone under incredible pressure. But in particular, it's placed disproportionate pressure on poor communities of color, precisely where community gun violence concentrates. The second major cause is, in fact, these guns. We saw record sales of guns in 2020, continuing to 2021. And unfortunately, some recent ATF data shows that the quote-unquote time to crime, meaning the time a legally purchased gun needs to funnel through the gray and black markets into the hands of a criminal, has shortened considerably. And in fact, what we're seeing on the streets of our cities is that more illegal guns are being recovered despite the fact that there have been fewer arrests. The final thing that's driving these crime trends is the social unrest that followed the brutal murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And what that incident and other incidents like it did is it drove a wedge between cops and the communities they serve. And what we're seeing is we're seeing police alienated from communities and communities alienated from police. So we're seeing less proactive investigation from police, and we're seeing less cooperation in some of the most impacted communities.
So let me ask you what you've seen so far as mayors are responding. We just saw the New York City Mayor Adams there talking about how he'd like to respond to the increase in crime there, more police on the streets, but also empowering some of those community programs you were mentioning. We actually spoke with a gentleman in New York who works with a violence reduction program in a neighborhood of Brownsville. His name is Anthony Newrels. And here's what he told us about something they tried recently.
We asked the police department to let us, you know, police our own community. So it was a community-based led week resources, knowing the needs of the community, knowing that they have housing issues, mental health issues, summonses and warrants and food. We brought resources out for a week straight from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. and not one violent incident took place that week.
So Thomas, Anthony saying they actually pulled back on policing and they saw crime go down. Is that an approach more cities should be trying?
I think what cities need to do, and frankly, what I think Mayor Adams is doing, is try to strike the right balance. It's important to understand that police are essential to crime fighting, particularly fighting against the most serious forms of crime, such as violence. At the same time, police are necessary but not sufficient. So we also need partners for those police, including community groups like the one we just heard about. And so that's really the important thing. Unfortunately, across the country, far too often we're having sort of an either-or conversation. Either it's the police or it's these community groups. You're either for the police or you're against the police. And the science says we actually need both.
So what about this kind of knee-jerk reaction we see in a lot of places, right? People see crime numbers go up, and the immediate response from leaders who want to appear responsive and assertive is to say, we're going to answer with more police. We know, even with all the conversation around police reform, that more cities are spending a bigger part of their budget on police departments in the last year. So how do you encourage those leaders to make sure there's a mixed response? It's not just responding with police. These community programs are also getting funding.
Sure. Police funding as a share of overall state, local, and even federal budgets is remarkably consistent, and I wouldn't expect to see a major increase this year. But what I would say is that it's very important to understand that it's not necessarily more police that we need or less police. It's the right kind of policing. Serious gun violence is remarkably concentrated. It's concentrated in every city among a surprisingly small number of people and a small number of places, often known as microlocations or hotspots. And so, yes, we need police in those places. But no, we don't need to return to some of the practices that of mass arrest and mass incarceration that left us with really some of the highest levels of imprisonment. In the world.
That is Thomas Abt, chair of the Violent Crime Working Group, joining us tonight. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be with you.
It's been 7 weeks since a series of ferocious tornadoes tore through western Kentucky and surrounding areas, killing 90 people and making hundreds more homeless. Kentucky's governor and President Biden have promised whatever is needed to rebuild. William Brangham recently returned to the town of Mayfield and found a community struggling to get back on its feet.
Nearly 2 months on, it's still jarring to see block after block of utter destruction. Over 1,000 homes and businesses were hit by one of the most severe tornadoes this area had seen in decades. Survivors now live in hotels or state parks or with family far away. Huge hydraulic metal cutters pick through the wreckage, but they seem dwarfed by the scale of the work still to be done.
It's kind of like, and I hate to compare it to this, but it's like if you lose a member of your family and you go to a funeral and everybody shows up for the funeral and then they leave the next day and you're sitting there in silence in your home and everyone's gone, but you're still suffering. That's what this town is doing. This is the fairgrounds.
Joanna Schroer is the local constable in Mayfield. And since the tornado hit, she's become something of a one-woman relief effort.
Here. Do you guys have any medical supplies back here?
I don't think so.
Plenty of gauze bandages, medical tape.
Hunting through mountains of donated goods, Schroer is trying to steer this generous tide.
That's adorable.
Towards the very specific needs of her community.
Perfect. And I found this little toy here. Yes. Joanna.
Amanda, nice to meet you.
Amanda, I have stuff for you. Is your son here?
Yes, he is here.
So you're doing a whole lot better than what I was doing.
This young man in bed broke his leg in multiple places doing volunteer cleanup. He can't work now, and his family is struggling. Schroer brought bags of medical supplies for his mom to use.
And when I got that phone call, I was really scared. And
the people that I work with every day, they're mentally hopeful because the news keeps telling them to be hopeful. But the reality of it is they're in despair. Face to face, one-on-one, they're scared. They're very scared. They're scared what tomorrow is going to bring.
FEMA says almost 15,000 Kentuckians have registered for help. It and other federal agencies have given out over $35 million in loans and grants in the state. A quarter of that went to housing assistance and repair. And 1 million cubic yards of debris, that's about two-thirds the volume of the Houston Astrodome, has already been removed. There's another 3 million still to go. The needs are everywhere.
Right now, you let us help you.
Including another person Schroer is helping. Chance Pitts was injured by the tornado. He lost two cars, his job, and he's running out of money. Pitts worked at the candle factory in Mayfield that was completely flattened by the tornado. After the collapse, several employees claimed supervisors told them that if they left work in advance of the storm, they could lose their jobs. A state investigation is underway. Action lawsuit has been filed. Pitts isn't part of that suit. Company owners deny those accusations and say none of their supervisors told people they had to stay.
I was told by people there that they was not able to leave, so I did not ask to leave that day because I was more worried about having a job to support my family.
Pitts says that when the roof blew off, a large cinder block wall fell on him and several others, trapping them inside a pile of debris.
I'm sandwiched between the floor, other people underneath me, the walls, and all the metal on top of me. As soon as it first happened, I prayed to God to let me live. And then after I got done, I was able to reach into my pocket and call my wife and told her that I loved her and I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it home.
What did she say back to you?
To please not say that. And I told her that I didn't want to say it, but we was getting crushed by the moment.
Pitts was trapped inside that building for 5.5 hours. Among the 8 people who died in the factory that night, one of them was right underneath Pitts.
He has a strong sense of guilt. He feels that he should have been able to save her as he was trying so hard to save everyone that was in that compartment with him.
But he helped hold up a wall to protect all those other people.
That's correct. But you can save 20 and lose one and you'll worry more about that one than the other 20 because they're already out there with their families. And this woman is not.
I have dreams about it a lot, I will say that.
To this day?
To this day.
The wreckage of the candle factory has now been cleaned away. It seems like one of the fastest cleanup jobs in the area. We went to the site with Pitts and Schroer.
It's overwhelming.
For Schroer, who hasn't been back here since that first night when she called for help online.
This is the candle factory. This is where the tornado went through. There is nothing left of it.
Coming back today, seeing the place scraped clean was rough for her. For Chance Pitts, the company just announced the factory isn't rebuilding. He and most of the other employees are permanently laid off. Because he worked there just 3 months, he can't file for unemployment.
So what are you doing for money now?
Basically, at this point in time, I'm broke. Living on a prayer, I guess.
And how much longer do you think you can go like that?
Not much longer. When I have to go find another job, even though I got injuries, I'm going to have to work through it, you know what I mean? Bills don't pay themselves.
It's a dilemma that's facing this entire region.
You know, when you look at all of the businesses that have been affected, some of these businesses have moved outside of the city limits. Will they come back? Will they rebuild in Mayfield? I don't know.
Teresa Rochetti Cantrell was Mayfield's mayor for 8 years, and now she runs a large charitable organization in town. She says new money will come in time, but right now, Mayfield is desperate for funds.
I'm probably being aggressive when I say we've lost half of our tax base. But when you look at all of these, everywhere that there was a building, there was a value on that building. And now the value of that building is gone. And so it's going to be valued at just the vacant land. That's a huge deficit for city tax base.
Chance Pitt's experience mirrors much of what's going on in this whole community, damaged, hurt, and struggling to get back on its feet. Constable Schroer says she and lots of others will be here for the long haul.
Let's look at what we need to do tomorrow to make tomorrow better. Because this is not a 1 week repair here or a 2 week or a 6 month. This is years. This is years of commitment. And when the fanfare's over, the work is still here and has to be done.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in Mayfield, Kentucky.
The
The CDC reported today that a third shot of the Moderna or Pfizer COVID vaccines substantially reduced the risk of hospitalizations among people with weakened immune systems. This comes after both vaccine makers announced this week that they are moving forward with clinical trials for new boosters designed to guard specifically against Omicron. Amna Nawaz is back with a look at some of these developments. She spoke earlier today with one of Moderna's top scientists.
Dr. Paul Burton is the chief medical officer of Moderna, and he joins us now. Dr. Burton, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
Let's begin with vaccines and young kids, because this is on a lot of people's minds right now. Parents of kids under the age of 5 are really struggling, worried about how to keep their kids and families safe. A couple of weeks ago, Moderna had announced you're going to share efficacy data on your vaccine for kids age 2 to 5 by March. So should we take that to mean that parents shouldn't expect a Moderna vaccine for those young kids anytime before March?
Well, so look, first of all, I share those sentiments, certainly with Omicron. Those little kids, 2 to 5 year olds, have been disproportionately impacted and affected, and it's an unmet need. You know, we need a good vaccine for them. We are on track to have data, as you say, by March. We'll get that to regulators as soon as we possibly can afterwards. And the data that we've had in older children has been very reassuring. It shows excellent effectiveness. So I would be hopeful, we would be hopeful that the data from that study will be the same. And then obviously my R&D colleagues and the rest of the company will work with regulators to talk to the FDA and see how we can now get this approved.
But that timeline means that no time before March should they expect that from Moderna, correct?
I think that is a fair assessment, yes.
I'd like to ask you about Omicron specifically as well. You've talked about making an Omicron-specific booster available later this year. I believe clinical trials for that have just started. I guess the question is, why would those boosters be available or be necessary even later this year? Do you believe that Omicron is going to continue to circulate for many more months?
I think there's a couple of things. We presented some data in New England Journal of Medicine on Wednesday evening that showed that while there is still protection, there is waning of effect, waning of antibody levels around 6 months after a booster. I would also say it's clear to us now that Delta is still going to be here, Omicron is still going to be here. There's even now a stealth variant of Omicron. So I think as leaders in mRNA, as leaders in COVID, it's on us as Moderna to make sure that we have a vaccine available that can cover Omicron as well as Delta and other variants. You know, it's our responsibility to make that, provide that insurance.
You're saying this is something that Americans should expect to deal with for many months ahead?
We believe so. I mean, we're not going to eradicate the virus. Omicron may go down in numbers. As we go into spring and summer, people get outside. You know, maybe we can see a reduction in cases, but think we've had days where a million and a half Americans have been infected. Nearly 4,000 people a day have died in recent weeks. We have unprecedented levels of hospitalization today. While it may come down, I think it's proven time and time again that this is a virus that can take really radical steps of evolution and surprise us. So I would predict that we will need a booster dose just to keep everybody safe and protected in the fall of 2022.
Knowing what we know now at this point with the waning efficacy, is it fair to say people shouldn't consider themselves fully vaccinated unless they have 3 shots rather than just 2?
I would agree. I think that is what will provide maximal protection against death and hospitalization, and certainly against infection with Omicron and with COVID in general.
I think roughly half of the global population now is vaccinated. But as you know, in those low-income countries, the numbers are really abysmal. It's estimated about 1 out of every 10 people have just had their first shot. And many people will point to manufacturers like you refusing to waive the patents for those vaccines as part of the reason that gap perpetuates and persists, right? They say it limits manufacturing, it keeps prices artificially high. So why not waive those patents?
Well, so look, we've said that we certainly will not enforce any patents during this pandemic phase of the virus. I would also add that in 2021, out of the maybe 825 million doses of vaccine that we produced as Moderna, a quarter of those went to low and middle income countries, and we've committed to do another billion doses in 2022. We're actively looking to build our state-of-the-art manufacturing facility in Africa that will provide for Africa 500 million doses.
Can I just clarify, though, when you say you won't enforce the patent, is that the same as waiving the patent rights?
I think not. No, we have said that we will not enforce the patent during the pandemic phase. So if other people want to produce the vaccine during this time period, we would not enforce our patent rights, not during the pandemic phase.
But does that mean that Moderna is doing anything to enable other countries to produce it and manufacture it themselves?
Well, look, as I say, you know, certainly for Africa, we've committed to build and work with countries there to produce a state-of-the-art manufacturing facility that will produce vaccine doses for Africa in a country to be determined very soon. So, you know, we are doing everything
possible. When do you expect that facility to be up and
running? I think we're still working. We're going to hopefully announce a country in coming weeks, and then we'll work as fast as possible to actually get the facility up and running.
You've made billions of dollars on the sale of the vaccine, and mostly to wealthy nations. And there were numbers late last year for those who track those vaccine shipments that showed Moderna shipped a greater share of your doses to wealthy countries than any other vaccine manufacturer. So what would you say to critics who point to those facts and that say Moderna has not done enough to help those low-income countries?
As we now go into this next phase of the pandemic and hopefully into the endemic phase, you know, we'll continue to supply as much vaccine as we can to those low and middle income countries, and we'll expand our manufacturing facilities in those countries as well. So we're working with governments, we're working with those regions, again, to do everything possible. But, you know, it's a very difficult situation to supply as many people have been asking for our vaccine throughout last year. But I think we're in a better position now this year. We've learned a lot, and I think 2022 will see, you know, a new opportunity for us there.
That is Dr. Paul Burton, Chief Medical Officer of Moderna. Dr. Burton, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Syria is in the throes of several different major conflicts. In the northeast, Syrian Kurdish forces are fighting ISIS militants who forced a prison break a week ago. And in the northwest, Idlib province, President Bashar al-Assad and his Russian allies are continuing to pummel civilian areas with airstrikes. But as video journalist Abdul Razak al-Shani found, Syrian children are determined to pursue their education. And Ali Rogan has their story.
Each morning, the students at Al-Zahir Baybars Elementary greet their teachers outside. They line up grade by grade. They hold on to each other's shoulders as they enter school. The chatter subsides as they take their seats. Then it's time to learn. The routine is a precious bit of order and normalcy for young lives filled with chaos and war. They are in Idlib province in northwest Syria. It's the last stronghold of opposition against President Bashar al-Assad, who began a brutal crackdown against civilians in 2011. In mid-2019, Assad and his Russian allies started a campaign to retake Idlib, killing at least 1,600 civilians. Despite a ceasefire in March 2020, the bombings have continued, often targeting civilian infrastructure. Not even schools are safe. On a recent winter's day, the Syrian Civil Defense Forces, known as the White Helmets, installed an early warning system at Al-Zahir Baybars. The goal? Buying time to hide if the defense forces spot Russian jets. The children practice ducking under desks and escaping to the hallway, single file, in the same way they enter in the morning.
First things first, we're going to exit in an orderly way. So I will not exit until my classmate in front of me exits.
For 9-year-old Shahad, this drill is a bad memory.
We do this to protect ourselves from the bombing and so no one is killed.
She is among the 2 million Syrians in Idlib displaced by violence.
We fled our town because of the bombing. I am afraid to go to school sometimes because of the bombing.
But she still goes, hoping school remains a haven for learning and for protection. Not all of Idlib's children have the luxury of solid schoolhouse walls. At the Al-Sukari camp north of Idlib city, class takes place inside this tent. The nearest schools were destroyed by Russian airstrikes. But it doesn't seem to dampen the students' spirits as they learn the Latin alphabet and how to count in English. Children here make do with limited learning tools, but the sad reality is that some have none at all. 11-year-old Mahmoud Mandora had to drop out of school to support his family. His older brother was injured in an airstrike. His father has been in an Assad regime jail since he was born. Mahmoud found work at an auto shop in Idlib city and now spends 12 hours a day fixing cars, earning the equivalent of $2. In order to stay warm, he and another working boy burn old notepapers. They can't read them because they never learned how.
The work is difficult here and it's cold. When I go home, my back really hurts.
Mahmoud finds refuge on the back of a beat-up bicycle, which he restored himself using his tradesman skills. But he just wants to be a child again.
I hope to go back to school and to stop working this job. I hope my dad comes back from jail.
Up in the mountains of Idlib, 14-year-old Yaman Kurdi also had to grow up fast. He lost his leg when Russian bombs hit his school. He was in fourth grade.
The plane bombed us and we started running. Then it bombed us again. I was injured and saw my leg was amputated, and I tried to get up, but I couldn't get up.
Yaman and his family now live in a remote refugee camp a mile away from the nearest school. He and his father walk there together each day. It's hard for both of them. By the time they arrive, Yaman is in great pain.
His back hurts him. He comes back tired from school. He wants to learn, he wants to read, but he comes back so tired. The regime and Russia bomb the schools on purpose so they can kill learning and destroy the young people.
But they haven't killed Yaman's drive. He wants to become a doctor and help people like himself.
For me, the most important thing for Yaman is for him to learn. He's a good student, and he's doing everything he can, and he won't let us down.
The bombs robbed Yaman of a limb. But like so many children in Idlib, he refuses to let them steal his desire to learn. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Allie Rogan.
You might remember the unlikely but true story of the Jamaican bobsled team that made it to the Olympics. It was a feat popularized in the 1993 film Cool Runnings. Now, Jamaica's bobsled, or bobsleigh team, as it's called in British English, is at it again. Lucy Watson from Independent Television News explains.
Just like in Cool Runnings, the country's four-man bobsleigh team has qualified for the Winter Olympics. The last time was 24 years ago, so the hype is here.
Back home in Jamaica now, some people still don't realize that Jamaica actually have a bobsleigh team.
We look forward to kind of putting on the show. Energy,
energy.
Dancing skills,
yeah.
Love for our nation.
Most of the team were born in Jamaica, but live and train in the UK. And that training is hard.
It's a massive adrenaline rush, but it's like you're getting beaten up for a good minute. All that aggression you can find from anywhere in life, you just take out in that sled. So you see people go a bit crazy, growl. I tend to growl sometimes.
Growling is one thing, pushing vehicles is another. Shan Wayne is in the military and during lockdown had to tell the Queen how he'd been practicing.
I've been pushing a car up and down the street. I've had to make a gym.
Well, I suppose that's one way to train.
Yeah, that's definitely one way to train, Mum.
It's a really nice feeling, the way she reacted, and you can tell she generally was interested in what I was saying, so that was fantastic, and I think Jamaica bobsleigh's got a new fan.
With a lot more skill than the movie stars, they head for Beijing on Friday to put the fire on ice.
You've got to wish them luck. That was Lucy Watson from Independent Television News. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.